Immediately after World War II, the American people were subjected to a massive propaganda barrage, which favored the Chinese communists and frowned on the Chinese nationalists. Newspapers, books, magazines, and experts in government did their best to convince Americans that the Red Chinese were not communists at all, but were merely agrarian reformers seeking fair play for the Chinese people. In the midst of this propaganda blitz, our government completely turned its back on the nationalist Chinese in 1947, refusing even to sell them arms. By 1949, the communist forces under Mao Zedong had seized all of mainland China. After the communist takeover, serious students of the situation lost no time in declaring that China had been lost in Washington, not in Peking or Shanghai. And they were correct. Eventually, the full truth about the Chinese communists became widely known. This U.S. Senate subcommittee report, published in 1971, contains gruesome statistics which show that the Chinese communists have murdered as many as 64 million of their countrymen. Despite current propaganda to the contrary, communist China continues to this day to be one of the most brutal tyrannies in the history of mankind. And the Chinese Reds have exported revolution and terror to every continent. The American people were misled 30 years ago. If the truth about China had been widely known, our government would never have intervened in the Chinese struggle as it did. China would not have fallen into communist hands. There would never have been a Korean War in the 1950s, and there would never have been a Vietnam War in the 1960s and 70s. The course of history would have taken a far different path if only the American people had not been misled about the Chinese communists. In the late 1950s, the American people were again misled. We were told that Fidel Castro was the Robin Hood of the Sierra Maestra Mountains, that he was the George Washington of Cuba. Some Americans knew better and tried to spread the alarm. But in spite of their efforts, our government repeated the process it had followed in China, and Castro eventually seized control of Cuba. Again, the American people had been misled. If the truth about Castro had been widely known, our press and our government would never have aided him, and he would never have succeeded in capturing Cuba and in spreading communist subversion throughout Latin America and now even into Africa. The question we must ask ourselves today is, are there any other important but similarly erroneous attitudes that have been planted in the minds of the American people? The answer is that there certainly are. One dangerously wrong attitude held by many Americans is that all prominent businessmen in America, the American capitalists as they are called, are by definition the arch enemies of communism. In fact, the mere suggestion that a prominent capitalist like David Rockefeller is in league with communists invites scorn or ridicule. The notion appears to many to be totally absurd because a man like David Rockefeller, it seems, would have so much to lose if the communists should ever triumph. But in the last few years, David Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan Bank has been favored by the Reds as the first American bank to open an office in Moscow, and also the first to do so in Peking. And this same Chase Manhattan Bank has bankrolled the building of the largest truck factory in the history of mankind at a place called the Kama River in the Soviet Union. It is totally inaccurate to consider David Rockefeller an enemy of communism. It is also inaccurate to believe that all prominent businessmen in our nation are conservatives who are always the most determined opponents of socialistic government controls. We agree that businessmen should be anti-communists and that they should be advocates of limited government as given us by our founding fathers, but many are not. As communism continues to advance toward total world domination, as America's place in the world slips from undisputed leadership to second-rate status, and as our own federal government's control over all of us grows with each passing day, many Americans are looking for an explanation of what they see happening. We believe that the first step toward learning what is really going on in our country is the realization that some so-called capitalists are neither conservatives nor anti-communists. Instead, they are power seekers who are using their great wealth and influence to achieve political power. This program will take a hard look at what we perceive as an ongoing drive for power. Not only the kind of power that flows from great wealth, but absolute power. The kind that can only be achieved politically. We are going to take a look behind the headlines at the men who really run our country. The men whom Jimmy Carter called the insiders. One of President Jimmy Carter's favorite themes during his campaign for the presidency in 1976 was that if he were elected, he would bring new faces and new ideas to Washington. He repeatedly told campaign audiences that he was not part of the federal government and not beholden to the Washington and New York-based establishment that had been running things for so long. Perhaps the clearest example of his campaign oratory against what he called the insiders was given at a Carter for President rally in Boston on February 17, 1976. What he said on that occasion showed up in this widely distributed paperback. I'll never lie to you. Jimmy Carter, in his own words. On page 48, Mr. Carter's statement at that Boston rally is given as follows. The people of this country know from bitter experience that we are not going to get these changes merely by shifting around the same group of insiders. The insiders have had their chance, and they have not delivered. The message undoubtedly persuaded a good many Americans to cast their ballots for Jimmy Carter, for the existence of such an inside group running things is both widely suspected and widely resented. And yet, while the former governor of Georgia played up to this resentment throughout the campaign, he carefully avoided naming any names or discussing any of the organizational ties of the easily identifiable insiders. This we intend to do. For we agree with Mr. Carter's campaign oratory that for several decades, America has been run by a group of establishment insiders. We also intend to show that despite his strong pledge to the contrary, Jimmy Carter has literally filled his administration with these same individuals. Since Jimmy Carter moved into Washington, it has been business as usual for the insiders who are running the United States. The man popularly credited with devising the strategy that landed Jimmy Carter in the White House is Hamilton Jordan. A few weeks prior to the November 1976 election, he stated, "If, after the inauguration, you find Asai Vance as Secretary of State or Zbigniew Brzezinski as head of national security, then I would say we failed and I would quit. You're going to see new faces and new ideas." After the election, Mr. Carter promptly named Cyrus Vance to be his Secretary of State and Zbigniew Brzezinski to be head of national security. Exactly what Mr. Jordan had said would never happen. But the real question is, what is it about Mr. Vance and Mr. Brzezinski that prompted Jordan to make such a statement? And the answer is that these two men are pillars of the very establishment that candidate Carter so often attacked. When Jimmy Carter appointed him to be Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance was a Wall Street lawyer, the chairman of the board of the Rockefeller Foundation, and a veteran of service in the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon administrations. Zbigniew Brzezinski had taught at Harvard and Columbia Universities, served in the State Department during the Johnson administration, and authored numerous books and articles for various establishment publishers and periodicals. But beyond all of these establishment credentials, at the time of their appointment by Jimmy Carter, both Vance and Brzezinski were members of the board of directors of a little-known organization called the Council on Foreign Relations. Also, each was a member of the very exclusive Trilateral Commission. Most Americans have never heard of these two organizations, but knowing something about them is essential to understanding what has been going on in America for several decades. So let us examine first the Council on Foreign Relations, and then later on, the Trilateral Commission. The Council on Foreign Relations was incorporated in 1921. It is a private group which is headquartered at the corner of Park Avenue and 68th Street in New York City, in this building, given to the organization by the Rockefeller family in 1929. The CFR's founder, Edward Mandel House, had been the chief advisor to President Woodrow Wilson. House was not only Wilson's most prominent aide, he actually dominated the president. Woodrow Wilson referred to House as my alter ego, my other self. And it is totally accurate to say that House, not Wilson, was the most powerful individual in our nation during the Wilson administration from 1913 to 1921. Unfortunately for America, it is also true that Edward Mandel House was a Marxist whose goal was to socialize the United States. In 1912, House wrote this book, Philip Drew, Administrator. In it, he said he was working for, quote, socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx, end quote. The original edition of the book did not name House as its author, but he made it clear in numerous ways that he indeed was its creator. In Philip Drew, Administrator, Edward Mandel House laid out a fictionalized plan for the conquest of America. He told of a conspiracy, the word is his, which would gain control of both the Democratic and Republican parties and use them as instruments in the creation of a socialistic world government. The book called for the passage of a graduated income tax and for the establishment of a state-controlled central bank as steps toward the ultimate goal. Both of these proposals are planks in the Communist Manifesto. and both became law in 1913 during the very first year of the House-dominated Wilson administration. The House plan called for the United States to give up its sovereignty to the League of Nations at the close of World War I. But when the U.S. Senate refused to ratify America's entry into the League, Edward Mandel House's drive toward world government was slowed down. Disappointed but not beaten, House and his friends then formed the Council on Foreign Relations, whose purpose, right from its inception, was to destroy the freedom and independence of the United States and lead our nation into a world government. If not through the League of Nations, then through another world organization that would be started after another world war. The control of that world government, of course, was to be in the hands of House and like-minded individuals. From its beginning in 1921, the CFR began to attract men of power and influence. In the late 1920s, important financing for the CFR came from the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation. In 1940, at the invitation of President Roosevelt, members of the CFR gained domination over the State Department, and they have maintained that domination ever since. By 1944, Edward Mandel House was deceased, but his plan for taking control of our nation's major political parties began to be realized. In 1944 and in 1948, the Republican candidate for president, Thomas Dewey, was a CFR member. In later years, the CFR could boast that Republicans Eisenhower and Nixon were members, as were Democrats Stevenson, Kennedy, Humphrey, and McGovern. The American people were told they had a choice when they voted for president. But with precious few exceptions, presidential candidates for decades have been CFR members. But the CFR's influence also spread to other vital areas of American life. Its members have run or are running NBC and CBS, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Des Moines Register, and many other important newspapers. The leaders of Time, Life, Newsweek, Fortune, Business Week, and numerous other publications are CFR members. The organization's members also dominate the academic world. Top corporations, the huge tax-exempt foundations, labor unions, the military, and just about every segment of American life. Here is the Council's annual report published in 1978. The organization's membership list names 1,878 members, and the list reads like a who's who in America. 10 CFR members are U.S. senators. Even more congressmen belong to the organization. Sitting on top of this immensely powerful pyramid as chairman of the board is David Rockefeller. As you can see from this page in the CFR annual report, 284 of its members are U.S. government officials. Any organization which can boast that 284 of its members are U.S. government officials should be well known. Yet, most Americans have never even heard of the Council on Foreign Relations. One reason why this is so is that 171 journalists, correspondents, and communications executives are also CFR members, and they don't write about the organization. In fact, CFR members rarely talk about the organization, inasmuch as it is an express condition of membership that any disclosure of what goes on at CFR meetings shall be regarded as grounds for termination of membership. And so, very few Americans knew that something was wrong when Jimmy Carter packed his administration with the same crowd that has been running things for decades. When he won the Democratic Party's nomination, Jimmy Carter chose CFR member Walter Mondale to be his running mate. After the election, Mr. Carter chose CFR members Cyrus Vance, Harold Brown, and W. Michael Blumenthal to be the Secretaries of State, Defense, and Treasury, the top three cabinet positions. Other top Carter appointees who are CFR members include Joseph Califano, Secretary of HEW, Patricia Roberts Harris, Secretary of HUD, Stansfield Turner, CIA Director, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Presidential National Security Advisor, and Andrew Young, Ambassador to the United Nations. The names of scores of assistant secretaries, undersecretaries, ambassadors, and other appointees can also be found on the CFR membership roster. As we have already noted, a total of 284 CFR members hold positions in the Carter administration. To put it mildly, the CFR has a great deal of clout. In our opinion, however, not every member of the CFR is fully committed to carrying out Edward Mandel House's conspiratorial plan. Many have been flattered by an invitation to join a study group, which is what the CFR calls itself. Others go along because of personal benefits, such as a nice job and a new importance. But all are used to promote the destruction of U.S. sovereignty. Over the years, only a few members have ever had the courage and awareness to speak out about the CFR. These few are now ex-members, who have always been ignored by the press. The CFR publishes a very informative quarterly journal called Foreign Affairs. More often than not, important new shifts in U.S. policy or highly indicative attitudes of political figures have been telegraphed in its pages. When he was preparing to run for the presidency in 1967, for instance, Richard Nixon made himself acceptable to the insiders of the establishment with an article in the October 1967 issue of Foreign Affairs. In it, he called for a new policy of openness toward Red China, a policy which he himself later initiated in 1972. The April 1974 issue of Foreign Affairs carried a very explicit recommendation for carrying out the world government scheme of CFR founder Edward Mandel House. Authored by State Department veteran and Columbia University professor Richard N. Gardner, himself a CFR member, The Hard Road to World Order admits that a single leap into world government via an organization like the United Nations is unrealistic. Instead, Gardner urged the continued piecemeal delivery of our nation's sovereignty to a variety of international organizations. He called for an end run around national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece. That means an end to our nation's independence. And he named as organizations to accomplish his goal the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the Law of the Sea Conference, the World Food Conference, the World Population Conference, disarmament programs, and a United Nations military force. This approach, Gardner said, quote, can produce some remarkable concessions of sovereignty that could not be achieved on an across-the-board basis, end quote. Richard Gardner's preference for destroying the freedom and independence of the United States in favor of the CFR's goal of world government thoroughly dominates top circles in our nation today. The men who would scrap our nation's constitution are praised as progressives and far-sighted thinkers. The only question that remains among these powerful insiders is which method to use to carry out their treasonous plan. Unfortunately, the Council on Foreign Relations is not the only group proposing an end to the sovereignty of the United States. In 1973, another organization, which now thoroughly dominates the Carter administration, first saw the light of day. This one is called the Trilateral Commission. The Trilateral Commission's roots stem from this book, Between Two Ages, written by Zbigniew Brzezinski in 1970. The following quotations from the book show how closely Brzezinski's thinking parallels that of CFR founder Edward Mandel House. On page 72, Brzezinski writes, Marxism is simultaneously a victory of the external active man over the inner passive man, and a victory of reason over belief. On page 83, he states, Marxism, disseminated on the popular level in the form of communism, represented a major advance in man's ability to conceptualize his relationship to his world. And on page 123, we find, Marxism supplied the best available insight into contemporary reality. Nowhere does Mr. Brzezinski tell his readers that the Marxism in the form of communism, which he praises, has been responsible for the murder of approximately 100 million human beings in the 20th century, has brought about the enslavement of over a billion more, and has caused want, privation, and despair for all but the few criminals who run the communist-dominated nations. On page 198, after discussing America's shortcomings, Brzezinski writes, quote, America is undergoing a new revolution, which unmasks its obsolescence, end quote. We disagree. America is not obsolete. On page 260, he proposes deliberate management of the American future, with the planner as the key social legislator and manipulator. The central planning that he wants for our country is a cardinal underpinning of communism, and the very opposite of the way things are done in a free country. On page 296, Mr. Brzezinski suggests piecemeal movement toward a, quote, community of nations through a variety of indirect ties and already developing limitations on national sovereignty, end quote. Here we have the same proposal that has been offered by Richard Gardner in the CFR publication Foreign Affairs. Brzezinski then calls for the forging of community links among the United States, Western Europe, and Japan, and the extension of these links to more advanced communist countries. Finally, on page 308 of his 309-page book, he lets us know that what he really wants is, quote, the goal of world government, end quote. Zbigniew Brzezinski's Between Two Ages was published in 1970 while he was a professor in New York City. What happened, quite simply, is that David Rockefeller read the book. And in 1973, Mr. Rockefeller launched the new Trilateral Commission, whose purposes include linking North America, Western Europe, and Japan, quote, in their economic relations, their political and defense relations, their relations with developing countries, and their relations with communist countries, end quote. The original literature of the Trilateral Commission also states, exactly as Brzezinski's book had proposed, that the more advanced communist states could become partners in the alliance leading to world government. In short, David Rockefeller implemented Brzezinski's proposal. The only change was the addition of Canada, so that the Trilateral Commission presently includes members from North America, Western Europe, and Japan, not just the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. Then David Rockefeller hired Zbigniew Brzezinski away from Columbia University and appointed him to be the director of the Trilateral Commission. Later in 1973, the little-known former governor of Georgia, Jimmy Carter, was invited to become a founding member of the Trilateral Commission. Mr. Carter was later to say, "Membership on this commission has provided me with a splendid learning opportunity, and many of the members have helped me in my study of foreign affairs." We don't doubt that for a minute. When Jimmy Carter won the nomination for the Democratic Party, he chose CFR member and trilateralist Walter Mondale to be his running mate. Then, the man who told America that he would clean the insiders out chose Cyrus Vance, W. Michael Blumenthal, and Harold Brown for the top three cabinet posts. And each of these men is a trilateralist as well as a CFR member. Other trilateralists appointed by Mr. Carter include Zbigniew Brzezinski as National Security Assistant, Andrew Young as Ambassador to the United Nations, Richard N. Gardner as Ambassador to Italy, and several others as top government officials. The membership list of the Trilateral Commission now notes 17 former members in public service, including Carter, Mondale, Vance, etc. Their places on the commission have been taken by other influential Americans, so that approximately 80 Americans, along with 10 Canadians, 90 Western Europeans, and 75 Japanese are members today. Among the current trilateralists can be found 6 senators, 4 congressmen, 2 governors, Hedley Donovan, the editor-in-chief of Time Incorporated, Winston Lord, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, William E. Brock, chairman of the Republican National Committee, and Dr. Henry Kissinger. As with the CFR, we do not believe that every member of the Trilateral Commission is fully committed to the destruction of the United States. Some of these men actually believe that the world would be a better place if the United States would give up its independence in the interests of world government. Others go along for the ride, a ride which means a ticket to fame, comfortable living, and constant flattery. Some, of course, really do run things and really do want to scrap our nation's independence. On March 21, 1978, the New York Times featured an article about Zbigniew Brzezinski's close relationship with the president. In part, it reads, "The two men met for the first time 4 years ago when Mr. Brzezinski was executive director of the Trilateral Commission and had the foresight to ask the then obscure former governor of Georgia to join its distinguished ranks. Their initial teacher-student relationship blossomed during the campaign and appears to have grown closer still. The teacher in this relationship praises Marxism, thinks the United States is obsolete, and is the brains behind a scheme to end the sovereignty of the United States for the purpose of building a world government. And the student is the president of the United States." Let's summarize the situation we've been describing in 3 short statements. First, President Carter, who was a member of the insider-controlled Trilateral Commission as early as 1973, repeatedly told the nation during the 1976 political campaign that he was going to get rid of the establishment insiders if he became president. But when he took office, he promptly filled his administration with members of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, the most prominent insider organizations in America. The second part of our summary. The Council on Foreign Relations was conceived by a Marxist, Edward Mandel House, for the purpose of creating a one-world government by destroying the freedom and independence of all nations, especially including our own. Its chairman of the board is David Rockefeller, and its members have immense control over our government and much of American life. And the third statement in our summary, the Trilateral Commission was conceived by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who praises Marxism, who thinks the United States is obsolete, and who also wants to create a one-world government. Its founder and driving force is also David Rockefeller, and it too exercises extraordinary control over the government of the United States. The effect of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission on the affairs of our nation is easy to see. Our own government no longer acts in its own interest. We no longer win any wars we fight, and we constantly tie ourselves to international agreements, pacts, and conventions. And our leaders have developed blatant preferences for communist USSR, communist Cuba, and communist China, while they continue to work for world government, which has always been the goal of communism. The insider domination of our government is why America's leaders now give the back of their hands to anti-communist nations, such as South Korea, Rhodesia, Chile, and our loyal allies in Taiwan. These few nations do not want to join with communists in a world government, and therefore they are being suppressed. In short, our government has become pro-communist. The Carter administration, unfortunately, is only the current manifestation of this problem that has infected our nation for decades. Previous administrations, however, have carefully pretended to be anti-communist and pro-American. But there is very little pretense in an administration which arranges to give the Panama Canal to a communist-dominated government in Panama and pays the Reds $400 million to take it. Or when our president turns his back on America's allies in China and diplomatically recognizes the Red Chinese who run the most brutal tyranny on earth. Or when our president continues to disarm and weaken the United States even as he presses for more aid and trade with Red China and Red Russia. The foreign policy of the Carter administration, which is totally dominated by CFR and Trilateral Commission members, could hardly be worse. But the domestic policies of our government also fit into the scheme to weaken the United States and to destroy the freedom of our people. Government-caused inflation continues to weaken the dollar and destroy the economy of our nation. Federal controls continue to hamstring America's productive might, and the Carter energy policy can be summed up very simply as a program to deny America the use of its own energy resources and to bring this nation to its knees through shortages and dependence on foreign suppliers. The real goal of our own government's leaders is to make the United States into a carbon copy of a communist state, and then to merge all nations into a one-world system run by a powerful few. And in 1953, one of the individuals committed to exactly that goal said as much in a very explicit way. That individual was H. Rowan Gaither, a CFR member who was the president of the very powerful Ford Foundation. It was during the preliminary stages of a congressional investigation into the activities of the huge tax-exempt foundations that Mr. Gaither invited Norman Dodd, the director of research for the Congressional Committee, to Ford Foundation headquarters in New York City. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss the reasons why Congress wanted to investigate the foundations. At that meeting, Rowan Gaither brazenly told Norman Dodd that he and others who had worked for the State Department, the United Nations, and other federal agencies had for years, quote, operated under directives issued by the White House, the substance of which was that we should make every effort to so alter life in the United States as to make possible a comfortable merger with the Soviet Union, end quote. Then he added, quote, we are continuing to be guided by just such directives, end quote. When the thoroughly shocked Norman Dodd asked Rowan Gaither if he would repeat that statement to the full House committee so that the American people would know exactly what such powerful individuals were trying to accomplish, he said, this we would not think of doing. As further proof of just how powerful these subversive influences already were in the early 1950s, the committee headed by Congressman Carol Reese of Tennessee never did get to the bottom of its investigation of the tax-exempt foundations, and it was soon disbanded. A summary of what was learned appears in this book. But the drive toward a merger of the United States with communism continues. The final goal, as we have already stated, is a world government ruled by a powerful few. And lest anyone think that such a development will be beneficial to the world or agreeable to himself, let us list four certain consequences of world government. 1. Rather than improve the standard of living for other nations, world government will mean a forced redistribution of all wealth and a sharp reduction in the standard of living for Americans. A second consequence of world government, strict regimentation will become commonplace. There will be no longer any freedom of movement, freedom of worship, private property rights, free speech, or the right to publish. 3. World government will mean that this once glorious land of opportunity will become another socialistic nightmare, where no amount of effort will produce just reward. And a fourth consequence of world government is that world order will be enforced by agents of the world government in the same way that agents of the Kremlin enforce their rule throughout Soviet Russia today. That is not the kind of a world that anyone should have to tolerate, and it is surely not the kind of an existence that a parent should leave for a child. Yet that is what is on our near horizon right now, unless enough Americans decide to stop it. The John Birch Society was organized in part to stop the drive toward world government. In 1966, Robert Welch, the founder and leader of the John Birch Society, delivered a speech which he called The Truth in Time. In it, he gave a brief history of the goals of the communist conspiracy. One of the most important sections in this valuable survey is Robert Welch's discussion of the individuals who are carrying out the conspiracy's goals, but who have never been communists. Mr. Welch coined a word to describe these powerful men. He called them the insiders. And among the insiders can be found some of the most prominent American businessmen, those who support communism, who promote government controls, and who want world government. Strangely enough, we have seen that Jimmy Carter attacked what he too called insiders during his campaign for the office of president. We are, however, making no inference that Mr. Carter used the word because Robert Welch had. The amazing aspect of this coincidence is that in using the word insiders, both Jimmy Carter and Robert Welch were referring to the same individuals and to the same force. But Jimmy Carter only went so far in discussing the insiders because he had obviously thrown in his lot with them and was dishonestly seeking votes by condemning them. Robert Welch, on the other hand, has condemned the insiders, named the insiders, and formed the John Birch Society to stop what they are doing to our country and to the world. And that is where you who are watching this film come in. The insiders must be stopped. The control they have over our government must be broken. And the disastrous policies of our leaders must be changed. The way to accomplish these urgent tasks is to expose the insiders and their conspiracy. The American people must be made aware of what is happening to our country and who is doing it. If sufficient awareness can be created in time, the insiders and their whole sinister plan will be stopped. This is the goal of the John Birch Society. Education is our strategy and truth is our weapon. But more hands are needed to do the job. More hands are needed to wake the town and tell the people. You don't have to be a political scientist or an economist or a PhD in world history to be a member of the John Birch Society. The most important single requirement has always been a sense of right and wrong and a preference for what is right. If you want to do your part to save your country and to stop the insider-controlled drive toward a communist-style world government, then you ought to join the society now. The John Birch Society has the organization, the experience, the tools, and the determination to get the job done. God help us all if, for want of willing hands, we fail to succeed.
John Birch Society's film strip presentation, The Insiders, was released early in 1979. Over 1,200 copies were purchased and put into use by members in a matter of months. Several hundred thousand copies of the printed text in booklet form were also purchased and distributed throughout the nation. In addition, reprint permission was granted to several other publishers, and their efforts undoubtedly doubled the readership of this analysis of the powerful few who dictate American policy. It is impossible to know how many Americans either saw or read The Insiders or one of the many similar treatises which parallel it or were stimulated by it. Millions for sure. Tens of millions most likely. By early 1980, the accumulated exposure of the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations, the two most identifiable insider organizations, had begun to produce some dramatic effects. For one, these organizations became well enough known to be hot topics on the campaign circuit. Informed voters from coast to coast, especially those who were disenchanted with the Carter administration, began to seek candidates who were not tied to either of these groups. In New Hampshire, for instance, where the first presidential primary is held every 4th February, most of the candidates for the Republican nomination were happily responding to voters that they were not now and never have been members of David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission or his Council on Foreign Relations. But Republican candidates George Bush and John Anderson could not join in such a response because each had connections to both of these elitist organizations. This issue was not confined solely to New Hampshire either. It was a nationwide phenomenon. Witness this February 8, 1980 article in the New York Times reporting on a Ronald Reagan campaign trip through the South during the first week of February. This article stated that Mr. Reagan had attacked President Carter's foreign policy because he had found that 19 key members of the administration are or have been members of the Trilateral Commission. It also noted that when Mr. Reagan was pressed to back up his charge, an aide listed the names of President Carter, Vice President Mondale, Secretary of State Vance, Secretary of Defense Brown, and 15 other Carter officials. Then, the report stated that Reagan advisor Edwin Meese told the reporters, "All of these people came out of an international economic industrial organization with a pattern of thinking on world affairs." He added the very interesting comment that their influence led to a softening of our nation's defense capability. Both he and Mr. Reagan could have added that practically all of these Carter administration officials were also members of the Council on Foreign Relations, but neither chose to do so. The history of that period shows that Ronald Reagan exploited this issue very capably. On February 26th in New Hampshire, where the matter had become the deciding issue in the primary, voters gave him a lopsided victory. His strong showing and the correspondingly weak showing by George Bush delighted the nation's conservatives and set a pattern for future victories that carried Mr. Reagan all the way to the White House. But something else happened on February 26th, 1980, that should have raised more eyebrows than it did. On the very day that Ronald Reagan convincingly won the nation's first primary, he replaced his campaign manager with longtime Council on Foreign Relations member William J. Casey. Mr. Casey served as the Reagan campaign manager for the balance of the campaign and was later rewarded with an appointment as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The selection of William J. Casey in the strategically important position of campaign manager is highly significant. He is a New York lawyer who served the Nixon administration in several positions, including Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs and Chairman of the Export-Import Bank. In those two posts especially, he gained a reputation as a crusader for U.S. taxpayer-financed aid and trade with communist nations. During the same period, while serving as an official of the State Department, he declared in a public speech given in Garden City, New York, that he favored U.S. policies leading to interdependence among nations and to the sacrificing of our nation's independence. These attitudes are thoroughly in agreement with the long-term objectives of the insiders, but are not at all consistent with the public positions being taken by Mr. Reagan. But very few made note of the Casey appointment because very few knew anything about Mr. Casey. With CFR member William J. Casey on the team, the Reagan campaign was still able to focus attention on the Trilateral Commission and on fellow Republican George Bush's ties to it. But nothing was said about the older, larger, and more dangerously influential Council on Foreign Relations. In April of 1980, Mr. Reagan told an interviewer from the Christian Science Monitor that he would shun the directions of David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission. But George Bush, who had recently resigned both from the Trilateral Commission and from the board of the Council on Foreign Relations, could not shake the stigma of his insider connection. In Florida, understanding about the Trilateral Commission led to widespread use of a political advertisement which claimed that the same people who gave you Jimmy Carter want now to give you George Bush. An identical ad appeared in Texas. The Reagan bandwagon, propelled in part by its attack on the insiders, began to score one primary victory after another. Eventually, Ronald Reagan convincingly won the Republican nomination. Conservatives across the nation were delighted. That is, they were delighted until he shocked his supporters by selecting George Bush as his running mate. George Bush was the very epitome of the insider establishment type that had made so many of these people strong Reagan backers in the first place. That night at the Republican convention, the word betrayal was in common usage. Ronald Reagan had repeatedly and publicly promised that he would pick a running mate who shared his well-known conservative views. But of all of the Republicans available, he picked the man who was the darling of the Rockefellers. Nor was the Rockefeller-Bush relationship any secret. Campaign finance information had already revealed that prior to December 31, 1979, the Bush for President campaign had received individual $1,000 contributions, the highest amount allowed by law, from David Rockefeller, Edwin Rockefeller, Helen Rockefeller, Lawrence Rockefeller, Mary Rockefeller, Godfrey Rockefeller, and several other Rockefeller relatives and employees. Staunch Reagan supporters frantically tried to stop the Bush nomination, but political considerations quickly forced them to go along. One after another, they began to state that their man was still at the top of the ticket. It was Reagan-Bush, not Bush-Reagan, they said. But all had to admit that the issue of trilateral domination of the Carter administration could hardly be used with a trilateralist veteran like Bush on the ticket. From the time William Casey joined the Reagan team in February, the issue of CFR domination of America could not be used. And when George Bush was tapped as the Reagan running mate, the trilateral issue was also lost. Only a very few realized that when those two issues were lost, the hope that a future President Reagan would keep insiders from key positions in government was also lost. As the summer of 1980 faded into fall, insiders were showing up in every conceivable part of the Reagan campaign. On September 30th, a casual prelude to victory party was given by the Reagans at their rented East Coast home in Middleburg, Virginia. This photo shows that the place of honor at Mr. Reagan's immediate right was given to none other than David Rockefeller, the leader of the CFR and the Trilateral Commission. Guests at this party included Dr. Henry Kissinger and a generous assortment of other CFR and trilateral members. 2 weeks before the election, the front page of the New York Times carried this photo showing the future president campaigning in Cincinnati. Alongside him as his foreign policy advisors, whom the president said would answer questions for him, were, from right to left, Senator Howard Baker, former Ambassador Ann Armstrong, and former Secretaries of State William P. Rogers and Henry Kissinger. All were members of either the CFR or the Trilateral Commission, or both. Election Day 1980 produced a Reagan landslide. Caught up in misguided euphoria, conservatives began talking about the return of fiscal and diplomatic sanity to the federal government. But the shock they felt when their man had chosen George Bush as his running mate returned when President-elect Reagan announced his selections for the new cabinet. For Secretary of State, he chose Alexander Haig, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. For Secretary of Treasury, Donald Regan. And for Secretary of Commerce, Malcolm Baldrige, both members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Back in February, Edwin Meese had told reporters that Mr. Reagan opposed the Trilateral Commission because the organization's influence led to a softening of defense. Yet, he chose for his Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, a member of the Trilateral Commission. Men from the same insider team were still in power. 5 months after Mr. Reagan had been sworn in as president, the Council on Foreign Relations noted in its annual report that 257 of its members were serving as U.S. government officials. As in previous administrations, these individuals filled many of the important assistant secretary and deputy secretary posts at the State Department, Defense Department, Treasury Department, and so on. For the critically important post of White House Chief of Staff, Mr. Reagan named James Baker III. The White House Chief of Staff determines who gets to see the president, what reading material will appear on his desk, and what his policy options might be on any given situation. But James Baker had fought against Ronald Reagan as the campaign manager for George Bush in 1980 and as a campaign staffer for Gerald Ford in 1976. He is a confirmed liberal who was an opponent of the philosophy enunciated by Mr. Reagan during the 1980 campaign. In his White House post, he leads a team of like-minded men who have virtually isolated the president from many conservatives who supported his election bid. As president, Mr. Reagan has been given the image of a tough anti-communist and a frugal budget cutter. But the images do not hold up under close scrutiny. Only 1 year after taking office, he acquiesced in the taxpayer-funded bailout of Poland's indebtedness to large international banks. Even worse, he skirted the law, which mandates that any nation in such financial difficulty must be formally declared in default before the U.S. government could assume its debts. What made this action doubly revealing was that it occurred at the very time that thousands of Polish citizens had been incarcerated in a typical communist crackdown against even a slight semblance of freedom. During 1981 and 1982, Ronald Reagan personally signed authorizations for the U.S. Export-Import Bank to finance nuclear steam turbines for communist Romania and power generation equipment and a steel plant for communist China. Tens of millions of U.S. taxpayers' dollars are being provided for the industrialization of these red tyrannies. Also, Reagan administration officials announced plans to sell arms to Red China. They told anti-communist businessmen in El Salvador that the U.S. would oppose efforts by any anti-communist Salvadorans to gain control of their country. And these same administration officials refused to honor a pledge to supply free Chinese on Taiwan with the fighter planes deemed necessary by the Chinese for defense. When the president authorized a joint Peking-Washington communique, which stated that military support for the free Chinese is no longer our nation's long-term policy, even CFR member Dan Rather of CBS News called the document a startling reversal of frequently stated Reagan rhetoric. On the domestic front, the record of reversals is just as dramatic. When Mr. Reagan campaigned against Jimmy Carter, he said he would cut 2%, $13 billion, from the fiscal 1981 budget, which he would inherit if elected. He did nothing about that budget. Instead, he went to work immediately on the budget for the following year. On February 18, 1981, in one of his first speeches to the nation as president, he delivered his own budget proposals. In that address, he stated, "It is important to note that we are reducing the rate of increase in taxing and spending. We are not attempting to cut either spending or taxing to a level below that which we presently have." Yet America was inundated with propaganda which had practically everyone believing that the Reagan economic package contained a substantial reduction in federal spending. Supposed budget cuts were labeled massive, drastic, historic, and cruel. But simple arithmetic showed that what President Reagan proposed for fiscal 1982 was $40 billion more spending than could be found in the 1981 budget. By the end of fiscal 1982, instead of being reduced, as candidate Reagan had promised, that figure has grown to a $70 billion increase over spending from 1981, and the deficit associated with it soared to $110 billion. But the Reagan reputation, which had been gained by his campaign oratory and by erroneous descriptions of his economic program, continued to delight conservatives and anger liberals. At a press conference 1 year later on March 31, 1982, a reporter asked the president to respond to the accusation that he cared little for the nation's poor. Part of his lengthy response included the following statement. Maybe this is the time, with all the talk that's going around, to expose once and for all the fairy tale, the myth, that we somehow are, overall, cutting government spending. We are not gutting the programs for the needy. He then heatedly boasted that federal spending for student loans, welfare, meals, rents, job training, and Social Security was higher than it had been under Jimmy Carter's last budget. It was the Reagan-led conservative philosophy that won a decisive victory in the 1980 elections. Promises to get tough with the communists, to cut spending, to balance the budget, and to abolish the departments of education and energy appealed to millions. But there has been no change in the government's direction. America continues to help communists and to harm our nation's anti-communist friends. Federal spending continues to grow, and deficits are skyrocketing, and the bureaucrats at the departments of education and energy are still in place. At the halfway point of the Reagan four-year presidential term, the director of the Congressional Budget Office forecast budget deficits in the $150 billion range for the Reagan-directed fiscal years 1983, 1984, and 1985. Others insisted that the deficits would be even higher. The largest deficit in the nation's history prior to the Reagan administration was $66 billion during the Ford years. Budget deficits, of course, translate into inflation, high interest rates, business slowdown, higher taxes, and unemployment. If federal spending were no more than federal revenue, if we had the benefit of a balanced budget, in other words, some of these problems would be far less severe. Shortly after he took office, Mr. Reagan twisted the arms of conservative senators and congressmen to get them to raise the ceiling on the national debt. Had he insisted on no further increases, the spiraling growth of government could have been checked. But instead, he used his influence to authorize more debt. Then he did the very same thing again 8 months later and again in 1982. As a result, interest on the debt alone grew to $117 billion for fiscal 1982. In his State of the Union address on January 29, 1982, President Reagan again appealed to conservative Americans when he stated, "Raising taxes won't balance the budget. It will encourage more government spending and less private investment. Raising taxes will slow economic growth and destroy future jobs. So I will not ask you to try to balance the budget on the backs of the American people. I will seek no tax increases this year." But in August 1982, his actions again failed to parallel his rhetoric, and he used all the muscle he could muster to get Congress to pass the largest tax increase in our nation's history, $227 billion over 5 years. Opponents of this huge tax increase were the principled conservatives who had supported his election bid. The president's allies on the tax increases included big spending liberals like Senator Edward Kennedy and Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill. One result of the failure of the Reagan administration to stand by the philosophy which brought the president to the White House is that conservatives everywhere have been blamed for the nation's woes. The congressional elections of 1982 amounted to a significant setback for the entire conservative movement. It seemed to many voters that the conservative program had been tried and found wanting. The truth is that the conservative program has yet to be tried. And the reason why it has not been tried is that the insiders who surround Ronald Reagan are still in control. The president himself supplied dramatic evidence of the existence of this control in comments he made about the $5.5 billion increase in gasoline taxes that he signed into law on January 5, 1983. At his press conference on September 28th, he was asked, "Knowing of your great distaste for taxes and tax increases, can you assure the American people now that you will flatly rule out any tax increases, revenue enhancers, or specifically an increase in the gasoline tax?" Mr. Reagan responded, "Unless there's a palace coup and I'm overtaken or overthrown, no, I don't see the necessity for that. I see the necessity for more economies, more reductions in government spending." Less than 3 months later, he was vigorously promoting that increase in the gasoline tax. call it a palace coup or whatever, the chain of events certainly suggests that someone other than the president is in control. When CFR member Alexander Haig resigned as Secretary of State, CFR board member George P. Shultz was immediately named to replace him. During confirmation hearings, several senators and a number of political writers worried openly about what became known as the Bechtel connection. It seemed almost sinister to them to have Mr. Shultz join another former Bechtel Corporation executive, Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, in the Reagan cabinet's inner circle. But the senators and the supposedly hard-nosed, prying reporters were assured that there was no cause for alarm, and the matter died. If, however, a common corporate lineage of these two cabinet officials stirs concern, why is there no concern whatsoever over the fact that both are current members of the Council on Foreign Relations? And why not even a bare mention of the fact that Mr. Shultz would now be the 10th Secretary of State in a row to hold CFR membership before or immediately after his tenure? That the CFR owns the State Department can hardly be denied, but it can be ignored, which is precisely what has been going on in America for decades. The result? Most Americans remain totally unaware that the same powerful insiders still control our government. The Council on Foreign Relations rarely receives any press coverage. When confronted by adversaries, spokesmen for the organization repeatedly insist that it is merely a glorified study group which takes no positions and has no stated policy on foreign or domestic affairs. Rather, they insist the CFR merely offers the diverse thinking given by important students of world affairs. Yet, in an unusually frank article about the Council appearing in the New York Times for October 30th, 1982, author Richard Bernstein obviously reflected the attitude of CFR executives with whom he had spoken when he wrote, "It, the Council, numbers among its achievements much of the country's post-World War II planning, the basic ideas for reconciliation with China, and the framework for an end to military involvement in Indochina." If an organization takes no positions and has no stated policies, how can it list as achievements the shaping of some of our government's most important decisions over the past 40 years? And what achievements these have been. Post-World War II planning has seen the United States descend from undisputed world leadership and the admiration of virtually all nations to being militarily threatened by the USSR and being despised by almost everyone else. Post-World War II planning, for which the CFR claims credit, has seen the United States bumble its way from a defeat here to a setback there, to an error in judgment somewhere else, while freedom has retreated everywhere and the world increasingly falls under communist control. Reconciliation with China, rather than being an achievement, puts our nation in bed with the world's most brutal tyranny and is making us adversaries of the friendly, productive, free, and honorable Chinese on Taiwan. Nor is the disgraceful conclusion to our military involvement in Indochina anything of which to be proud. The NSAW three nations, Laos, Cambodia, and South Vietnam, fall to typically brutal communist tyranny. The toll in human slaughter, which has followed in the wake of our nation's pullout from Southeast Asia, is indescribable. And those who said that these nations would not fall like dominoes are now strangely silent. It is highly significant to see this corroboration of our long-held belief that the CFR helps to shape our nation's policies. The policies noted in this New York Times article have produced communist victories in every case. It is therefore even more significant to have this admission of the remarkable dovetailing of CFR and communist goals. The Trilateral Commission also attempts to convey the impression that it exists merely as a high-level discussion group which merely fosters economic and political cooperation. In 1982, the Commission released East-West Trade at a Crossroads, which it quickly claimed contained only the views of its authors. This study recommends an increase in the trade with communist nations that fueled their military capabilities, even after noting that the communist bloc nations are already heavily in debt to the West and that previous trade had produced no significant change in the foreign policy of the Soviet Union. The study also recommends supplying even more credit to stimulate greater trade. That credit, of course, is to be supplied by America's taxpayers. Nor is this any departure from previously held positions published by the Commission or enunciated by its members. What is most significant is that the recommendations given by this Trilateral Commission report are wholly in tune with the policies both of the U.S. government and the governments of the communist bloc nations. The American people do supply the communist nations with equipment, technology, and credit, even while communist troops crush Poland and ravage Afghanistan, and while Soviet missiles are menacing the United States. What this Trilateral Commission publication recommends is no less consistent with Soviet desires than have been the so-called achievements of the Council on Foreign Relations. The insiders of the Council on Foreign Relations and the newer Trilateral Commission have been controlling U.S. policy for decades. Unfortunately, these same individuals are still running things, despite the fact that the nomination and election of Ronald Reagan can be substantially attributed to a growing national revulsion at years of insider control of this nation. How, then, can one explain Ronald Reagan, the man on whom so many Americans placed such great hope? All we can say is that there are several theories to choose from, all of which fall in the realm of speculation. One theory holds that he is a good man with fine instincts and excellent intentions, but is such a hater of confrontation that he has effectively been steamrolled by the non-conservatives who surround him. Another theory holds that he was never a real conservative in the first place, but is a very capable orator who can read a good speech and produce a convincing image. The United Republicans of California published such a view in 1975, after having experienced all of the years that Ronald Reagan governed their state. One individual who shares the view that Mr. Reagan's political effect has never been conservative is Thomas Gale Moore of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. In a syndicated column appearing in May 1981, he discussed the much-publicized Reagan plans to cut spending and reduce bureaucratic regulation. But Mr. Moore then cautioned, "Skeptics find President Reagan's record as governor, often alluded to during the campaign, far from reassuring, especially since he used much the same rhetoric during his gubernatorial campaigns as appeared later during his campaign for the presidency." Mr. Moore added, "While in Sacramento, he converted the state income tax into one of the most progressive in the nation, introduced withholding taxes, raised sales taxes, and sharply increased taxes on business." Still quoting Thomas Gale Moore, "While he was in office, California government expenditures increased faster than was typical of other states. Notwithstanding his campaign rhetoric, welfare expenditures alone escalated 61% in real terms during his two terms as governor." That is hardly a record that should merit the label conservative. A third theory would excuse the president by holding that government is out of control in the fiscal sense and that previously arranged international entanglements are so binding that not even a president can reverse runaway spending or call a halt to the increasingly obvious pro-communist stance taken by Washington. Happily, there are not too many who believe that this theory has any validity. Finally, another theory, which is not inconsistent with certain aspects of the first two theories given above, is that while Ronald Reagan is indeed the president, he is not the boss, nor have a number of his predecessors really been in charge. Instead, the insiders who really run America select a man whom they then permit to occupy the White House, but it is they who still run the government through like-minded individuals with whom they surround the president. When Ronald Reagan announced that CFR member Donald Regan was to be his Secretary of the Treasury, an aide pointed out that Mr. Regan had donated $1,000, the maximum personal contribution allowed by law, to Jimmy Carter's re-election campaign, and that in 1980, Donald Regan had also contributed to and raised money for left-wing congressmen who were engaged in tight races with conservative, Reagan-backed challengers. When an aide asked then-President-elect Reagan why he would choose a man with such a background, Mr. Reagan is reported to have said, "Why didn't anyone tell me?" Why indeed did Ronald Reagan place Donald Regan in his cabinet? We suggest that he did not make the selection, but that the insiders made it and have made many others, and that such a practice has been the rule rather than the exception for years. In late 1960, when John Kennedy formed his cabinet, his selections included Robert McNamara for Secretary of Defense. At a gathering prior to their taking office, Mr. Kennedy had to be introduced to Mr. McNamara. Could he logically have picked a man to be Secretary of Defense whom he had never met? Or is it not more reasonable to assume that the selection had been made for him? As Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara did a great deal to destroy our nation's then unchallenged military advantage. Time magazine reported that Richard Nixon selected Henry Kissinger for the White House post of Director of National Security, based on having once met him at a cocktail party and having read one of his books. Yet CFR member Henry Kissinger was widely reported to have wept publicly when his patron, Nelson Rockefeller, lost the 1968 Republican nomination to Richard Nixon. Did Nixon choose Kissinger? Or were the reports in U.S. News and World Report and elsewhere correct when they openly stated the Rockefellers placed Kissinger in the Nixon administration's inner circle? There is, of course, nothing wrong with any president relying on the advice of others in selecting his top assistants. What is vitally important is whose advice is being followed, what type of individuals are named to the positions, and what they do with the power given to them. It is our view, as we implied earlier, that a tightly knit and very powerful group has run America far more than has any recent president. Its effect on our nation has been horrible. We call this group the insiders, and we dare to label their activity a conspiracy. A conspiracy which must be exposed and routed if the disastrous national policies of the past several decades are to be reversed. The route that must be followed in order to accomplish this reversal must begin by placing the mass of evidence about this conspiracy before the American people. A well-informed public will then work to see that it is represented by men and women at the congressional level who will not be intimidated or corrupted by insider influence in government, in the press, the academic world, the big labor unions, or anywhere else. The insiders may indeed have working control of the presidency and the mechanisms for choosing a president, but their clout at the congressional and senatorial level is a great deal smaller and exists largely through bluff. In time, a sufficiently aware public can even break the insiders' grip on the White House itself. Will America continue on a path which amounts to fiscal suicide? Will our government continue to build and support communism everywhere while it works simultaneously to destroy the few remaining anti-communist nations? The John Birch Society wants to put an end to insider control of the policies of this nation. If we are to succeed, the active help of many more Americans is needed in a massive educational crusade. Whether or not you decide to help will count heavily toward whether the future of this nation will be enslavement or freedom. The insiders are hoping that you will do nothing. But true Americans everywhere are asking for and counting on your help. The best kind of help you can give is active support for and membership in the John Birch Society.